This is VOA News. I'm Tom McNeil. U.S. President Trump signed two measures that show support for Hong Kong's democracy protesters angering Chinese leaders. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
The two measures passed nearly unanimously in the House and Senate last week after months of unrest on the streets of Hong Kong. President Trump had expressed some reservations about the effects of those statements since he's negotiating a trade deal with China's President Xi Jinping, who suggested there could be countermeasures if Trump signed the bills. One mandates sanctions on Chinese and Hong Kong officials who carry out human rights abuses. The other bans the export to Hong Kong police of items like tear gas, rubber bullets, and tasers that could be used against demonstrators. President Trump says he signed the measures with the hope of a peaceful resolution. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
The death toll from the strongest earthquake to hit Albania in more than three decades rose to at least 30 Wednesday. As the country observed a day of mourning, the government declared a state of emergency for the areas affected the most as rescue crews discontinue work to pull people from the rubble. Rescue teams and specialized crews were dispatched from neighboring Kosovo, Italy, and Greece. At least 15 civilians were killed and two people injured in a roadside bombing in Afghanistan Wednesday. An Afghan Interior Ministry spokesman accused Taliban insurgents of planting the bomb in troubled Kunduz region. The United Nations has documented around 2,600 Afghan civilian deaths in the first 9 months of 2019. The New York-based Human Rights Watch claims it has damning evidence showing the Turkish-backed Syrian National Army is engaged in summary executions, pillaging, seizing properties, and preventing the return of people to their homes. Last month, Turkish forces and the SNA launched an offensive in northeast Syria against Syrian Democratic Forces. This is VOA News. U.S. President Trump knew of a whistleblower complaint when he released aid to Ukraine. That's according to the report filed by AP's Mike Gracia.
President Donald Trump released nearly $400 million in military aid to Ukraine after he was briefed on a whistleblower complaint about his dealings with that nation, according to two officials not authorized to discuss the matter publicly. The officials say Trump was told about the whistleblower complaint in late August during a briefing by White House counsel Pat Cipollone and John Eisenberg, an attorney with the White House National Security Council. According to the officials, at that briefing, the lawyers told Trump they were trying to determine whether they were legally required to give the whistleblower complaint to Congress. Trump released the aid to Ukraine on September 11th. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador on Wednesday rejected interventionism after U.S. President Trump said he was working to designate the Latin American countries' drug cartels as terrorist organizations. Reuters' Gavino Garay.
López Obrador said Mexico would take up the issue after the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday on Thursday and that he had asked his foreign minister to lead the talks. President Trump floated the idea in a radio interview with conservative personality Bill O'Reilly on Tuesday. A growing chorus of conservative voices in the United States has called for Mexican cartels to be classified as terrorist groups after the killing of 9 Americans with dual Mexican nationality in Mexico earlier this month. But Mexico fears such a designation could, under U.S. law, enable the United States to act directly against the threat if it so chose. Trump had offered in a tweet after the massacre of the Americans to help Mexico wage a, quote, war on the drug cartels. An offer, Trump says, Mexico declined.
That is Reuters' Garino Garay reporting. In a statement emailed to VOA Persian on Tuesday, a BBC spokesman said the London-based network has seen an increase in Iranian harassment of its Persian service staff and their families since the network began covering anti-government protests that erupted in Iran on November 15th and spread to dozens of cities. Within days, the Iranian government violently suppressed the protests, which were sparked by the sudden increase in gas prices amid a weakening economy. London-based rights groups Amnesty International said Iranian security forces killed at least 143 protesters in the unrest, and with some people set fire to buildings and looted stores, Iranian authorities have not released a death toll. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
me, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti, Washington. Today is Thursday, November 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A new report recommends how Kenya can deal with future electoral problems.
So we want to see a new Kenya. We want to see all the people of Kenya united, working together as one people. That was the purpose of this BBI thing.
That's opposition leader Raila Odinga. Diaspora Ethiopians keep an eye on their country's fledgling democracy. Sudan strives to stop violence against women. A London exhibit of African revolutionary leaders showcases the late Fidel Castro's support for those leaders. And Zimbabwe's health system cripples as senior doctors join an ongoing strike.
Zimbabwe's biggest hospital, Babenyaba General, looked deserted as patients were being turned away after senior doctors joined their junior colleagues who have been on strike for 3 months.
That's reporter Columbus Mavunga in Harare. And UNICEF says there is a lack of progress in access to treatment for children with HIV/AIDS. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Kenyan task force has recommended sweeping governmental changes, including restoring the post of prime minister, establishing a mixed cabinet, and devoting more resources to avoid future election unrest. The report by the Building Bridges Initiative, BBI, comes 2 years after Kenya's heated 2017 election that almost split the country. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
At a public gathering attended by thousands of Kenyans, President Uhuru Kenyatta on Wednesday bemoaned the country's strife-laden political challenges and welcomed governmental reforms proposed by the Building Bridges Initiative, or BBI, in a newly released report.
Tofauti zetu sio kubwa vile, mashindano ndio inatuletea shida.
Kenyatta says our differences are not that big. What is bringing all this problem is political competition. Our opinions are not that different. He says, we decided to sit and even look beyond 2017 election. Why is it after every 5 years, Kenyans must fight each other, we must shed blood, destroy properties, business comes to a halt, and fear engulf our people? These questions were the beginning of the Building Bridges Initiative idea. Kenyatta says, the BBI task force formed in March 2018 when opposition leader Raila Odinga and President Kenyatta met in the aftermath of the heated 2017 election that almost split the country. The task force has sought to guide a national discussion on the country's political future as Kenyatta serves his final presidential term. The report recommends retaining Kenya's presidential system while empowering president to appoint a prime minister from parliament in hopes of promoting ethnic diversity and balance in the government. Kenyans are being urged to read the report and provide feedback. Initial reactions appear positive from both the government and key elements of the opposition. Odinga said the BBI report will unite the country.
So we want to see a new Kenya. And out of this, a new Kenya is going to emerge. Kenya that you all want to see. You want to see all the people of Kenya united, working together as one people. That was the purpose of this BBI thing.
But praise is not universal. Opposition Senator Ledama Olekina of Nare County slammed the proposed BBI reforms.
One of my biggest problems that I have with this report is that during Moi era, we talked about a dictatorial state. Now we are talking about an imperial presidency where you've given that president all the powers to choose who is going to be the prime minister, to choose who is going to be the cabinet secretaries. I think it is wrong. Let us give Kenyans an opportunity to elect their own leaders.
Political commentator Martin Andati says Kenya's leaders have missed what is really ailing the country.
The issues which have made us fight and the issues which caused the polarization in the country were captured very well by the late Kofi Annan in the Agenda 4 issues. But nobody has, none of the Agenda 4 issues is being fully addressed. The solution is in what Kofi Annan told us, a lean commission, which is fairly representative, but you also have a proper functional electronic voting system. Nobody's talking about that.
Kenyans lived through bouts of political violence in 2017, 2013, and in 2007, 2008, when former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan worked to end the strife. Kenyans will have several weeks to read and debate the 156-page report's recommendations, which could be decided in a referendum or by parliament. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Senior doctors in Zimbabwe joined their junior counterparts on Wednesday in a general strike over low wages that they say are not keeping up with high inflation. Healthcare workers said they will continue their strike, which began Tuesday, to protest the dismissal of junior colleagues who walked out in September, paralyzing the country's health delivery system. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Zimbabwe's biggest hospital, Parenyatwa General, looked deserted as patients were being turned away after senior doctors joined their junior colleagues who have been on strike for 3 months. Margaret Mashava brought in her pregnant sister, Marvel, whom she suspects may have complications after a C-section operation. She says, now we are stranded, we do not know what to do. There are no nurses at the clinics. We do not know. Maybe we will approach midwives since there are no doctors now. We do not know what to do, she says. Zimbabwe senior doctors on Wednesday said in a statement that they had watched over the past few months as the situation in our hospitals deteriorate. No bandages, no gloves and syringes available. In response, the employer, that's the government, unlawfully withheld their salaries. The authorities are so vindictive that they went to a medical theater to hand a letter to a doctor who was finishing an emergency operation. For the record, the senior doctors will not be reapplying to go back to work, ends their statement. Tawanda Rakada from the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association said he hoped that the government would swiftly act now that the senior doctors had joined the strike.
Doctors are not neglecting patients at all.
He says doctors are not neglecting patients at all, but they have been put in a situation that they cannot do anything. This is solely to blame on the government side. We have reiterated that we are not on strike, but incapacitated. The will is there, but we do not have the capacity. Once we are capacitated, you will see doctors at hospitals, says Shakada. Being incapacitated is the word government workers are using to justify staying at home, saying their salaries of below $100 in some cases cannot make them meet their basic demands. President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government claims it cannot pay more to its workers, but critics point to skewed priorities, an apparent reference to frequent foreign trips and buying luxury vehicles by senior officials, while the social sector is ailing and largely depends on foreign donors. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Diaspora Ethiopians are finding new ways to contribute to the elections set to take place in their homeland in 6 months. It will be the first time Ethiopians will vote since the previous government collapsed in 2018 after continued protests. Martha van der Wolf reports from London.
Dozens of Ethiopian activists, journalists, and politicians have lived in exile for many years. They fled their home country when dissident voices were repeatedly suppressed and jailed in the past few decades. Many only felt safe to visit again after mid-2018, when the previous government was ousted. The exiles are closely watching the ongoing unrest in Ethiopia and contemplating how they can help. Kinfu Asafa remained active as a journalist even after being forced to move to the Netherlands. From there, he has seen changes at home and he worries about the strength of Ethiopia's democratic institutions. From a distance, he sees a role for exiles like himself.
I didn't see proper preparation for the upcoming elections. Neither the ruling party nor opposition groups have done anything so far to mobilize the nation. Activists and exiled journalists could contribute a lot towards a positive development in the country. We can engage ourselves to ongoing changes through dialogue and discussion. We can contribute a lot through knowledge transfer, for instance.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed released many political prisoners and won the 2019 Nobel Peace Prize for ending hostilities with Eritrea in the past year and a half. His reforms also opened up more space for civil society organizations. Activist Bekele Wacheya has been living exiled in Britain for the past 14 years, working with civil society organizations. Because of his experience, he co-founded the Ethiopian Institute for Leadership, Communication and Organization in the hope of strengthening civil society ahead of the elections.
The agenda of the country should be set by ordinary citizens, folks on the ground who are actually having life on a daily basis, who are exposed to problems. So it is them who should decide what's important for them. It's not the elites who are further away from the reality that should decide the agenda of the day. So it's important for me and others to step in and support in organizing folks.
Many new parties will stand in the elections scheduled for May 2020. One such party is Ginbot Sabat. Outlawed by the previous government, it merged with seven other political parties. Seplawar Tadesse was part of Ginbot Sabat, but her political activism landed her in prison for 18 months. Facing possible arrest again, she moved to Australia. Despite political reforms in Ethiopia, she does not see herself going back and running for office.
I myself was been engaged in Ethiopian politics in from early age, and I'm lucky I had a chance to be part of that. I know it's not easy. It's very hard. I like to mentor more young women to be interested in their own country, and in the politics, in economy, and also social of the country.
Ethiopia is plagued by ethnic tensions and violent unrest that analysts warn could disrupt the election process if they are not resolved. A successful referendum was held in November, granting the Sidama ethnic group self-determination, but it took several postponements before the vote could go ahead peacefully. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 28th. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. Sudan has joined a global campaign aimed at stopping violence against women. Sudan's efforts at the national level involve the broad participation of artists, politicians, and civil society. Naba Muhyiddin reports from Khartoum.
For the first time in three decades, Sudan has joined the International 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence campaign, sponsored in the country by the Ministry of Social Welfare, Women and Child Affairs. At a press briefing, Social Affairs Minister Lina Sheikh praised women participating in political change in Sudan and the social activity of females. She says its impact would be widespread. As-Sheikh says the government launched the 16 days campaign nationwide to defeat violence against women. This year, she says, they are intending to develop efforts and resources to enhance health, economics, and the social situation for women, girls, and children in the towns, cities, and the camps. Decades of poor economic conditions and civil war resulted in thousands of displaced women relocating to refugee camps in the west and the east of Sudan. Hundreds of Sudanese women face trial under Sudanese criminal law every year. The laws were introduced in 1991, the same year the international campaign began. The laws allow police to arrest women for their clothing, appearance on the streets, and how they behave in public with men. The punishment varies from public whippings to detention and fines. Campaign participant Isha Abdulaziz is from Sudan's Blue Nile State, which suffered decades of war under former President Omar al-Bashir's government. She said her participation in the campaign is to help women in war zones. Abdulaziz says she participates in the campaign because she has witnessed some of the violence against women. She said that as a girl who has lived in conflict areas, she knows how women are repressed and used sexually. Sudanese women also are affected by a law that legalizes the marriage of 10-year-old girls and female genital mutilation. The international campaign runs every year from November 25th through December 10th. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Posters of Africa revolutionary leaders and figures are on display at London's House of Illustration as part of an exhibit showcasing Fidel Castro's support for those movements. The exhibit, titled Designed in Cuba, Cold War Graphics, features posters made by Cuban illustrators from the 60s onwards to help spread messages about African liberation movements in Angola, Guinea-Bissau, and others. Olivia Ackman, the curator of the exhibition, spoke to Ricky about what makes it unique.
What was really interesting about the work of the design studio Ospal was a number of things, but one of them was that they had a group of Cuban designers, sort of a core of four people, and then freelancers coming from in and out. So about 50 designers contributed in total from the 1960s to the 1990s to sending messages from Havana, but to the whole world, including to African liberation movements. So although Ospal was an international organization, what the Ospal studio did was express Castro's support for African liberation movements, among many other things.
A lot of these illustrations are not only beautiful, but they also highlight the role and the support that women provided in these movements. Do you know why that is?
The idea of collective solidarity is part of socialist movements throughout the 20th century, and the participation of women in every aspect of social and political life, including struggles for change. Ospal had a core of designers, as I mentioned, creative directors over the years. So at first, Alfredo Rosgarden, yes. Secondly, Rafael Enrique, and often the in-house designers were men, but actually a lot of women designers were brought in from outside Ospal to contribute as freelancers, and often they envisaged with women as warriors, women as contributors to different revolutions in different ways. So they really led the charge on that.
As an expert in illustration, what strikes you as some of the styles that are really distinctive of these posters? Is it certain colors or a certain typeface?
There are many things. One of the things that really sort of brings them together is that they don't have a common aesthetic in a way. So when we think about design from different socialist states, we might think of sort of state-imposed guidelines or rigid aesthetic guidelines, but that wasn't the case in Cuba or at Ospal. Designers had really sort of uncommon freedom to experiment with aesthetics, with approaches to visual metaphor. And so, as you say, they were using really bold colour combinations that were inspired by different aspects of pop culture. They were also using their experience working in capitalist advertising. So before the revolution in 1959, designers in Cuba were working promoting consumer goods, as designers do in the West today. And what Cuba's designers did was take some of those strategies from commercial advertising and apply them to the values of the revolution. So rather than creating propaganda that kind of tells you what to think or gives an idealized view of what a revolution or revolutionary ideas or radical ideas might, how they might result or what society might look like under a different way of thinking, they kind of appeal to your sense of humor or moral outrage. They kind of seduce you into looking.
That was Olivia Ackman, curator at London's House of Illustration. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says there is a lack of progress in access to treatment for children living with HIV/AIDS. A new UNICEF report says that last year, less than half of all children under the age of 15 who live with HIV received life-saving antiretroviral therapy. Mavis Autry reports from Washington.
About 320 children and adolescents die every day from AIDS-related cases in 2018, or 13 every hour, according to UNICEF's latest global snapshot on children, HIV and AIDS. The report says low access to antiretroviral treatment and limited prevention efforts are the leading causes of these deaths. Dr. Chewe Leo, a chief UNICEF's aid program, she notes there have been some key advances, such as getting more people to know their HIV status and reducing transmission to infants by providing antiretroviral therapy to mothers with HIV. However, Leo says only 54% of children with a virus receive antiretroviral treatments. She says the disease is aggressive in children. 30% of children born with HIV do not make it to age 2 if they do not get the required treatment, and 50% are lost by age 5.
We've grappled for a long time to find the right technologies to screen children 2 months as recommended by WHO. And that has meant taking samples from the babies wherever they are and having to transport them to central labs where the capacity is for infant diagnosis, and then transmitting the results back at the facility that the child accessed care. And that's been very, very complicated.
Leo says medical teams address the problem by using filter paper blood drops from HIV tests and transmitting tests quickly to laboratories. Even so, there is often a 50-day delay in getting results back, and that means more infants with HIV are likely to die in their first year because treatment starts too late. She says another challenge has been in working with drug companies and doctors to ensure that the drug formulations for children are correct. She says governments need to adopt the correct formulations and putting them on treatment guidelines for children. She says doctors need a new way to getting children treated. New technologies that allow the quick delivery of test results and treatment recommendation is one way to help because it eliminates the need for large laboratories to diagnose patients.
Game changer we're talking about is that it is unacceptable that adults are accessing treatment to the level that they are, and nobody's asking about what about the children. So one of the ways UNICEF is pushing hard on to get more children into care is to change the way we deliver services for adults for HIV. HIV is a family disease. So for any adult accessing treatment, we are actually saying, please go out and make sure that the children are brought into the system for care. And we think that we'll reach a lot of children by doing that.
Leo says the fight against HIV and AIDS is not just about policy interventions. For instance, studies show that more adolescents prefer self-testing because of the stigma and discrimination they face when they go to health facilities for testing. She says, however, that strides have been made around the African continent.
A lot of the progress in treatment access is in East and Southern Africa. For example, I'll tell you the biggest success story is the prevention of mother-to-child transmission. Who would have thought even 4 years ago that 82% of mothers will be accessing antiretroviral drugs for prevention of mother-to-child transmission, but also for the mother's health? If we look back to 2000, we know that we've been able to avoid up to 2 million child infections because of the prevention of mother-to-child transmission.
She says it is so frustrating that no country has yet earned the World Health Organization certification for eliminating mother-to-child transmission. She called on UNICEF's partner and national government to provide data on the age and gender of persons living with HIV and AIDS so gaps in treatment and prevention can be found and addressed. Reporting for the VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The South Sudanese government said it is disappointed with the State Department's decision to recall the U.S. ambassador to South Sudan. Ambassador Thomas Hoshek was recalled on Monday in what was widely viewed as a move signaling Washington's displeasure over South Sudan's failure to meet an extended deadline for forming a unity government, a critical component of a peace deal aimed at ending a bloody five-year civil war in the eight-year-old nation. South Sudan Ministry of Foreign Affairs spokesperson Mawi McCall called the U.S. diplomatic move a double standard, adding that South Sudan's president and opposition party have agreed that outstanding issues in the peace process have to be given time. The State Department has confirmed the recall of Ambassador Hoshek for consultations. Senior doctors in Zimbabwe joined their junior counterparts on Wednesday in a general strike over low wages that they say are not keeping up with high inflation. Healthcare workers said they will continue their strike, which began Tuesday, to protest the dismissal of junior colleagues who walked out in September, paralyzing the country's health delivery system. And a Kenyan task force has recommended sweeping governmental changes, including restoring the post of prime minister, establishing a mixed cabinet, and devoting more resources to avoid future election unrest. The report by the Building Bridges Initiative, the BBI, comes 2 years after Kenya's heated 2017 election that almost split the country. That is it for this Thursday, November 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell.
I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.